Seated.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's try again. Good morning. Thank you.
Like our preacher.
We have three hearings today on three rules petition, all relating to a BBE. So we can start with 0805 in the matter of the petition for amendment of two Supreme Court rules 3110, 3111 relating to notices of noncompliance with CLE requirements and reinstatement. The presenter is John Kasabuki. I have the other appearance by Jim Houston, vice chair of the Board of Bar Examiners. Is there anyone else who wishes to make an appearance? I don't see the multitude raising their hands, so we will hear from John Kasabuki, director of the Board of Bar Examiners.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson, distinguished members of this honorable court. May it please the court. We have three of the several petitions that the Board of Bar Examiners has pending before the court. Since my name is on there, I guess I get the either the credit for it or possibly the blame, but I'm fortunate to have the chair of our Rules Committee, who's also the vice chair, who actually drafted the petitions. There's not much controversy on any of these. 0805 pertains to the notices that go out when attorneys are suspended, and on the reverse side, when they are reinstated. Under the existing rules, there are some inconsistency as who gets the notices of suspension versus the notice of reinstatement. This proposal would correct the inconsistency by making both mailing lists the same. By practice, we have somewhat expanded who gets the notices of suspension. We've been requested by the Office of the State Public Defender for that list, since they frequently refer out cases and need to know attorneys who are on the suspension list. This petition is supported by the State Bar and their Board of Governors. The one concern would be the court commissioners. They don't have a consolidated email database for the court commissioners, so we would likely have to be sending those out via hard copy unless we could get a consolidated database. But I think that one is relatively simple, and it would correct the inconsistency between who gets the notices of suspension and who gets the notices of reinstatement. My understanding, the reason for the difference with the notices of reinstatement only going to the clerk of the Supreme Court, is that in many cases the reinstatement list would have only one name on there, and that name could be an attorney who is a non-resident attorney. But for consistency's sake, I see no problem in sending the list.
How about the clerks of circuit court?
I'm sorry?
What about the clerks of circuit court? I mean, they see lawyers. Lawyers check in with. I think that we have on our email list the clerks of circuit court, so we could do that without worrying about hand mail.
I would see no problem.
No, I say that
right,
because I think that's true, but we can check whether we've got that list. But if we do, I think that would then make it easy for both the judges in the county and the court commissioners and anyone else to get it, including tribal courts, which tend to keep the staff of the tribal courts and the staff of the circuit courts tend to know each other and can share that kind of information.
I think the wider the distribution on both lists, the better it would be.
And I'm talking about both suspension and the reinstatement. I mean, the same people who get the suspension ought to get the reinstatement. That's the whole point, one of the whole points here.
Okay? Agreed.
Is this list that's going to be sent out on suspensions, including
those folks who are suspended for example, non-compliance with an OLR letter in, you know, informing them there has been a complaint filed against them and there's not a response, and if they don't respond after a certain number of requests, then the OLR asks us to suspend them, and we do suspend them temporarily, pretty much uniformly, for non-cooperation. Would this suspended list include those people?
No, ma'am. This suspension pertains only to those who are non-compliance for the CLE reporting and attendance requirement.
Okay, so it doesn't, there's no cross-play then between the two?
Ma'am, there's
okay.
not.
Okay, thank you.
No.
One of the goals of this amendment is to make the list broader, and I note that previously the list was sent to the Clerk of Supreme Court as well as the Supreme Court Justices. I take no personal offense, but I noticed that we're no longer on the list. When it comes time for discussion, I'm going with the other justices, I'm going to advance that maybe we should stay on the list. Any objection or concerns that you have regarding that?
Absolutely none. Absolutely none. I would
hardly
agree with that.
Okay, there was a concern about registers in probate who no longer are on the list.
If they have a need for it, again, I see no problem.
Well, but there may be a problem because I'm not sure that the registered probate are, I thought I read something about in this, the register of probate can be handled simply by electronically rather than otherwise, but we'll check on the register of probate.
Final thing, as the U.S. District Court, Eastern District, used to be on the list and no longer is. Could you tell me why?
They were not in the original rule, but sometime over the years, the Eastern District had requested that list, so we included them.
Mm-hmm.
The Western District never had requested the list from us, so we did not send it to them. If it's easy to do, we could certainly include.
It isn't obvious to me. I just don't know the answer why the Eastern District would have requested it. But I assume out of some need, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe my assumption is incorrect. but I asked because there must have been something that propelled the request to get on the list.
Yeah, and that predates my hearing.
We're only talking about two people, the clerk of the Eastern District, the clerk on the Western District. So that's not a big problem.
No, ma'am.
Okay.
No.
Mr. Casabucci, the chief touched on this briefly, but she mentioned tribal courts or tribal judges. What about that?
We hadn't specifically considered them. Our understanding is that in some of the tribal courts, they have their own procedures, and they have their own admission procedures as to who can practice before their courts. In some cases, from what I understand, that they have non-lawyers who can be admitted to practice before the tribal courts. So we hadn't really considered tribal courts.
Well, what about municipal courts? There's 251, if I remember a figure I just looked at last week. Municipal judges in the state of Wisconsin, shouldn't they get notice?
My understanding initially, they were not considered courts of record, and that's why
they're not. But I would think they'd want to know if they've got a suspended attorney in front of them.
Of course, you don't have to be a lawyer to practice.
Well, I know that, but should a suspended attorney be practicing in municipal court?
I don't know, but that's the issue, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's an issue for another petition on the definition.
Well,
of
I don't think we are encouraging you to.
You're a troublemaker.
We're not encouraging you to bring in any more petitions. I think the an issue with the tribal judges and an issue with the register in probate is we don't have a list. The state bar maintains a list of tribal court judges as best it can. And both instances, we have to look to external sources to get that. And they'd have to be hand-done rather than electronically. So that is the issue. That's why I thought if we went through the clerk's office, it might be better, and that you might ask the clerk to advise the tribal court in its jurisdiction and advise the registers in probate. What do you think of that? You don't have to tell me now.
I think it's a brilliant suggestion.
Good. All right, but that's.
I've got one other thing. I know that the State Public Defender's Office is here this morning. They had requested they be included on the list. Any problem with that?
No, no. In fact, by practice over, I think, the last 2 years since I've been here, we have sent a copy to them when they did request it. I think it's a good idea because they do get outside counsel to handle some of their cases, and they need to know if an attorney is on the suspended list before giving a case to them.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you. Mr. Houston, you're marked as an appearance. If what you've said has been taken care of, that's fine. If you wish to speak, we'll hear you. You're not here on this petition? Okay. I'm not encouraging you or discouraging you. Okay. Thank you. That's fine. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kosoboki.
The next two petitions, 0806 and 0814.
Let me just close this.
Okay.
There's no further request to be heard on 0805, so the hearing on the matter of the amendment of 3110 and 3111 is now closed. We'll now have a hearing on 0806 in the matter of the petition for amendments to Supreme Court Rules 3113.2 relating to the manner of filing documents relating to CLE, Mr. Kosoboki. Okay.
Thank you. The current rule requires that the CLE reports be received in the office of the Board of Bar Examiners by the deadline date, which is February 1st. If it's received after that date, they are subject to a late fee. Similarly, the notice of noncompliance, which goes out before an attorney is suspended, gives them a deadline date by which they have to have their completed report in the BBE office. It's our understanding that this comports with the court policy. The other court agencies, such as the clerk's office and the Office of Lawyer Regulation, also require anything filed with them to be physically received by the deadline date. This rule change would apply to what's called the mailbox rule, where we would go by the postmark date of the mailing, and if it was postmarked prior to the due date, we would count that as a timely filing. There are other additional means by which they could comply with the deadline reporting, such as using a commercial carrier, such as FedEx or UPS, which will guarantee that it would be received within 3 days after it's posted through those agencies. Personally, I don't see any significant issues with this. However, I must point out to you that the Board of Bar Examiner staff has raised some objections that this would increase their workload. They did address this with Jim Morrison, board chair, at our last meeting, and he asked that I express to you the staff's concerns. They have provided me, this is a stack of mail, partial stack of mail that was received today, either without postmarks or with commercial postmarks that would cause some difficulty in deciding when an article was actually physically mailed.
So what does the staff want?
The staff would prefer that the rule not be changed.
Let me ask, what's the status of electronic filing of compliance with CLE?
System is up. It's running. There have been a few glitches. CCAP did another minor patch today. My understanding in talking with Tim Duggan in CCAP, the attorneys who have responded to the survey, the responses pro the electronic filing far outnumber the con or the concerns.
How does that then dovetail with the trigger being a postmark for compliance?
It would not, once the system is totally up and running, it would have no impact because they click the button to send, and it's put in the queue to verify that the information is correct. Mm-hmm. And right now, since we don't have an electronic signature rule, all that we need is the hard copy of the report form to get to the office. So if we've got the electronic version on file, the notice says that the hard copy, the actual signed form where the attorney attests that the information is true and correct, must be received within 5 days after his posting it on the electronic system.
This is in an upcoming proposed rule. Is that right?
The upcoming proposal would be for electronic signatures, which would eliminate the need to have the hard copy report come correct. I believe that's scheduled for sometime next year.
Right. That's for CLE we're talking about here.
Correct.
All right. We're not talking about bar applications yet.
Not yet, ma'am.
Okay.
Mr. Casabucci, one of the things that gave me a little bit of concern was the increase in the late filing fee. My understanding is it used to be $50. About 7 years ago, six, 7 years ago, we raised it to $100. The proposal now is to raise it to $500. Could you tell us?
That's on admissions under 0814. This is not under 0806.
The increase here?
The previous petition that we had here several weeks ago did raise the late filing fee on CLE from $50 to $100.
Which the court approved.
Which the court approved, correct.
So this one would not go to $500.
No, that is correct.
That's the next one.
That's the next one.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Correct.
Now, what about, is this the one that, what I'm bothered by, generally? Does this go to the board's office, or does it go to the clerk's office?
This goes to the board's office.
Okay. And is that true also about application?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. The board now has a post office address separate apart from everyone else.
Correct.
And how would I know what the board's office is? Is it the post office address? Is it the Tenney building? Where does it tell me? I mean, I know where the clerk's office is because it's smeared all over the place. It's on the website. Everybody uses the clerk's office. Why are we changing this to the board's office?
It has always been to the board's office that this is received. The problems, as you know, earlier this year, late last year, when the mail was
going to
DOA. That's
why you got a post office box. Right.
We got the post office box, and that has helped increase the mail. We have changed our letterhead to put the post office box on there. Our letters that were going out, we had a little sticky tag on there that said our new mailing address has the post office box on that. The post office box is also on our website, so that anything that we send out now highlights the use of the post office box versus the Tenney Street address.
Well, I think that. And where do you have in your rules or in the appendices or anywhere else a notice that what the post office, what the address is, what you mean by board's office? And how do you, can you hand deliver it to your office?
Yes, ma'am. And we do have a number
of people.
You
can't do that to the post office box because you can't fit in.
Correct.
Right.
The letterhead has both the post office and the street address and our suite number on it.
I know with the CLE, if they've already been in touch with your office, that it's got that. But I want to know if I'm new in the state and I haven't dealt with you before, how do I find all that out easily so I'm not struggling and sending it to the wrong place? Or when I get to the wherever I get to the Capitol, and you're not here. Or you're not in Jeff 1 or 2 or 3. Do you know what I'm trying to...
Yes, ma'am.
I want to make sure that, since we're going to clip them for $100, I want to make sure that they know where they're going.
Right. The CLE forms, our letterhead, and once we get the old envelopes out, they will have both the post office box and the street address and suite of the board's offices on them. That information, as I said, is also on our website, so it is available for people.
Send to your suite, it'll take a longer time to get there, won't it?
Because if it goes to the suite, it goes through DOA mail.
Right.
Right.
And then it's processed there, then sent over here, and then it has to get to you.
Correct. And that's where, by practice, I have, on my own initiative, taken the fact that if something came in past the deadline date because it went through DOA, I would then look at if there were a postmark on it and say, okay, I will accept that. And I've done that with in the past, most recently with some of the individuals who were on the suspension list because their forms went through DOA instead of through the post office box.
Okay. And you keep saying board in here. Is it okay if we change it to board's office?
That would be fine. I see no problem with that.
Right.
I understand the LRB is making that recommendation, so it is to the board's office, and mail through the post office box does get delivered to the board's office.
And what does the staff want you to do? Stay where you are with this?
I think they prefer the existing rule, but I don't think they really understood that their concern was that they would have to keep changing the date stamp based on when the mail was received. In discussing this with Mr. Houston earlier, that would not necessarily be the case, that we would stamp it when it was physically received. The only difference would be if it were something that were received after the deadline dates, then we would have to stamp it on based on the postmark date. And their concern was that some of the envelopes either have illegible postmark dates or no postmark dates or a commercial postmark that can be fudged somewhat depending on the postal machine that they're using where they can adjust the date. So based on that, the rule says that it cannot be a commercial postage on there. So we would be looking at an actual postmark on it. And if it didn't have one of those, then we would look at the document itself.
Is that the total number? Or is that just a selected sample?
This is a portion of today's mail, and this is a portion of the mail that came in, I believe, on Friday.
It's part of the mailing received on a particular date.
Yes, ma'am.
It could not be looked at quickly for postmarks.
Right. A number of these have illegible or missing postmarks, or they have the commercial postmark. One of the things that we notice, we provide our board members self-addressed envelope for them to send back their travel vouchers. I've noticed when they come back, we have our postage meter doesn't put a date on there, and there were no postmarks on those either. So depending on the postmark that the companies use, we would have to look at the documents as to trying to determine when they were mailed.
I'm not familiar with the workings of, let's say, most law offices with 15 people or more. Let me start with a large law office, many more than that. Would they be using a commercial postage meter so that there wouldn't be a postmark? Is that the norm, or don't you know what large law offices would do?
I would tend to think that most large law offices would use a commercial postage meter. Some of them they can set the date in there. Ours is set through the telephone lines, and so the date we cannot manually change the date on our postage meter, whereas my understanding on some postage meters you can.
So I don't know this, but I would guess that a lot of mid-sized law offices use postage meters, and even some smaller law offices use postage meters. That's my guess. But this rule doesn't allow for mail with commercial postage meters. You'd have to determine some other way to discern what's the trigger date. Am I correct or incorrect?
The problem is that some of the mail that comes with a commercial postage on it from either a meter that you can adjust the date yourself or one that's self-adjusted, mm-hmm. some of those do have a postmark on them. Mm-hmm. Others do not.
That's beyond my area of expertise, I guess.
Well, I tell you what's bothering me. I can understand for some matters that the time of filing is really very, very important. It's jurisdictional, and you got to call a halt. But why are we fussing about a CLE report? I mean, it seems to me if it's within a week of whatever date it's due, is it due December 31?
It's due February 1st. After February 1st, there's
a late fee. Within a couple of weeks of that, just call it a day and forget it. It costs you more to horse around with this.
And
if I understand from what these Vegas documents say, that if it comes within a reasonable time after the deadline, you just ignore that it's late anyway.
I have, on occasion, if something has come in late, I have looked at the envelopes and have accepted it after the deadline date.
Yeah.
So in practice, we have been doing that. The concern is that if there is no postmark date on the envelopes.
Well, most of them, I don't know how to get a postmark date on an envelope that I mail. I take it to the post office. No one wants to talk to me anyway. You know, I have to peek through the slot, stick my hand in, scream and yell, and I can't get anyone's attention anyway. So I have no idea whether it's postmarked or it's not postmarked, right?
Correct.
So the whole thing is bizarre with the post office. And
correct. If you give it to the clerk, he's going to throw it in the basket, and when they get to it, they'll run it through their machine and put a postmark on it. If you put it in your mailbox, the postman will pick it up, take it to the post office. They'll do their thing. Some of them you can read the postmarks, some you can't. I don't consider it to be a major issue, but I did want to express the staff's concerns, which I think, in discussing it with Mr. Houston earlier, can really be alleviated.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay. Mr. Houston, do you want to appear on this one? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kosovoki. You'll be back up, so don't go far.
I particularly like your idea, Chief Justice, of not bothering very much when these things come in close to the deadline. It's close enough for government work, and let's just get
offense
on
at that. unless it's a post office.
The board was not unaware of the staff's opposition when it recommended this petition to the court. We felt that, and in fact, we made a compromise in the draft to accommodate the staff, and that's this whole business of not allowing commercial postage meter marks to count. We thought that might ameliorate some of the staff's concern. Apparently, it has not. And so I'd be perfectly willing just to eliminate that problem, and we'll take whatever number, whatever date is on the envelope, whether it's from a commercial postage mark or otherwise.
Problem, as I understand it, is that the envelopes don't have many times clear dates.
The Supreme Court rule, United States Supreme Court rule number 29, which is mm-hmm. what we patterned this petition on, has another couple of sentences which say if you can't read the postmark or if there is not a postmark, you go back to the counsel that has filed the brief and ask for an affidavit of mailing. And if the affidavit of mailing is okay, then you accept the brief. We could do that.
That may be okay, and I'm not familiar with Rule 29. That may be okay for 75 cases that the U.S. Supreme Court handles, times two parties, times 100 amicus briefs for each case. That may be okay.
Well, we're dealing with, what, 15,000 lawyers here?
We're dealing with 8,000 per year, yeah, 15,000.
Yeah, because it's every 2 years. So we're dealing with 8,000 lawyers. You really want staff to call or write or email these lawyers? I don't. You don't either.
I'd rather use your practice, Your Honor. If it's within a week or two, let's just take it.
Yeah, but let's not tell anybody that.
That's fine.
Okay. That's our secret.
Okay.
Between us.
The purpose of this petition, we felt, was to make ourselves a little bit more customer-friendly than this board had a reputation for before John's time and before I was around. Whether it's a commercial postmark or not, Justice Bradley, doesn't make any difference except for those mailings that come in after the deadline. If they come in before the deadline, it doesn't make any difference what their postmark. They're on time. So we're really not talking about a huge bulk of these envelopes. We're talking about a relative few. But the automated, the online CLE reporting and eventually the online filing of applications to the bar will not eliminate mail, because there are a number of kinds of CLE credits that you can't, and as far as I know, never will be able to report online. For example, publication credits, or credits for programs that are approved in another state but that have not made it onto the Wisconsin database. So we're always going to have mailing, and there's always the possibility of a deadline that will be too rigorously enforced. Unless
I do have a comment, Mr. Houston. It just brings a smile to my face. You mentioned that the thrust is to be more consumer-friendly, and as you know, having been on the board, I've over the years had concern that the BBE was requiring the admittees from the law schools to use a typewriter in their application, and that was a area of great concern for me. And every year that we met with the board, I'd say, can they file with computers or something else? Do they have to try to find typewriters at St. Vincent's or wherever they have to find them? Although I think the law schools had a few typewriters that they had salvaged for them to use. Anyway, on Friday, I had lunch with some UW law students, and I was telling them about the BBE and this in my mind, advance for consumer friendliness. And one of the law students asked me, is the keyboard on a typewriter like the keyboard on a computer? She had never seen the keyboard on a typewriter. So, again, hats off to the board and to staff for making that change.
Thank you.
Tell her no.
Unless there are other questions of me, I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. Are there any other appearances on 0806 relating to 31132 CLE? Hearing none, the hearing on 0806 in the matter of the petition for amendment of Supreme Court Rules SCR 31132 relating to filing documents continuing legal education requirements is closed. We will now proceed to 0814 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 40.14.2. This is applications for admission and increasing the fees for late application under the diploma privilege. Mr. Kasaboki.
Thank you, Chief Justice. There are actually two parts to this 0814. The first is the mailbox rule, which is the exact same language as the previous petition, and I think we adequately discussed that. The second would be to raise the late fee for character and fitness investigation from $100 to $500. Over the years, we have very few of these late applications on diploma privilege which come in, but it does cause concern to the board that those applicants who are eligible for the diploma privilege should really take advantage of filing their applications timely. because if they don't, they could ultimately end up having to take the bar exam. And we felt that by increasing the late fee, that would give them additional incentive to get their applications in on a timely basis. What we have always been doing is meeting with the law schools early on and provide information on the applications, the filing. We have visits where we discuss the character and fitness requirements of their applications. Several weeks ago, I was asked to be a guest speaker at a professional responsibility course at the UW Law School for Marshall Mansfield, where we discussed the application, we discussed the character and fitness requirements, encouraging them to get their applications in on a timely basis. So I think the word is getting out, but we feel like there should be maybe a little heavier stick to encourage them to timely file their applications for admission on diploma privilege.
$500 is a little high.
Yes,
compared to the other fees around here. Talking about law students?
Yes.
Or even, I suppose, people who sit for the bar who are not qualified under one of the other rules?
The bar exam applicants have a different requirement. If their applications are late, they have a $200 late fee that they have to pay.
Does the $500 reflect any increased time for staff time, let's say, as opposed to the the bar exam admittees you said was 200, this is 500. Is there more involved if one is late rather than the other?
There is some minimal staff work because typically we present a packet to the board for the board to accept, excuse me, to accept the late filing. And then there would be some board action as to approving the late filing. But it's not significant, I would say.
It's the highest fee in anything you have? Is the $500, would that be the highest fee that you have any?
It would be the highest additional fee to be paid, correct. The bar exam fee is $450. If it's late, there's an additional $200. Application on motion is $850. So,
let me just ask you a question about all of these. Maybe not the CLA, but maybe the CLA. I've decided that all of these. You've got another petition coming in on electronic filing.
Correct.
Seems to me, and it seemed to me the last time we talked about these BBE piecemeal petitions, that the court ought to see them all together at the end and put them into effect at the same time, all together, rather than piecemeal. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I hadn't thought of that. Some of the additional petitions that are coming up relate to admission processes for foreign attorneys, registered legal consultants. They were just different types, and that's the reason the petitions were submitted separately.
But the electronic isn't a different type.
No, the electronics relates to the ability to use electronic signatures on the CLE and the application. Problem with the electronics on the application, it is on the CCAP strategic plan, but it doesn't have the highest priority. It's somewhere in the middle to get that done. So we would not have a fully automated application system for probably another 2 years. Right now they can fill out their applications online. They have to print it off and mail it in. Our staff then has to take the information on the printed application and input it into the program that we have. The goal is to, once the applicant fills out the information online, hits a send button, it would populate the data into the database, and that's what we're working for. But as I said, it's a medium priority right now for CCAP because of the other voluminous projects that they're working on.
The CLE can be filed now electronically.
The CLE can be filed now electronically. We cannot use electronic signatures. That petition is, I think that's, did we schedule a date for that one? We have not scheduled a date for that one yet, but I would anticipate that that would be sometime early next year for the electronic signatures portion.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Houston? Thank you, Mr. Kasabuki.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the CLE cannot be filed electronically this year. You can send in your report, assuming you don't have anything like publication credits or credits from out of state and so forth electronically. But even if you don't have any of those things, you still must send a paper report. A copy of what you have filed electronically must be sent in within 5 days of the time you submit the electronic report. So there is no change in the need for mailing at this point. The other thing I would like to rise to talk about is this $500 penalty fee. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about the history of our coming to that. If a graduate of Marquette or UW fails to get his or her application in by that deadline, it has been the practice of the staff and the board to deny this person the diploma privilege entirely, relegating the person to the bar examination. Over the last couple of years, under the rule that gives us the discretion to waive these deadlines when there is good cause, the board has often, well, at least several times, waived this failure to meet the deadline and granted the applicant the diploma privilege, part of our desire to be a little more customer friendly and getting rid of typewriters and so forth. These votes on the board are typically not unanimous. There are those, some members will say, yes, this is good cause, let's waive it. Other members say they don't realize what a wonderful privilege is this diploma privilege. They don't realize what a benefit it is not to have to take the bar exam. Let's stick it to them. The Rules Committee and ultimately the board decided that if we raise this penalty to a really stinging penalty, we are more likely to be able to get the votes to waive the failure of the deadline in the first place. So the question is, do you pay $100 and lose the diploma privilege, or pay $500 and you get to keep, and you have a shot at least at keeping the diploma privilege? That was the mindset of some members of the board that brought this petition to the court.
Would you charge someone $500 and then not give them the diploma privilege?
It would be a possibility.
Ooh.
But I think we actually know, because when there is an appeal, if the appeal is an appeal from the staff to the board, I believe we refund the late fee or a portion of the late fee if the appeal is denied. John says I'm right.
Yeah, he's on the bar application. Or bar exam.
How much in advance of the bar exam does the applicant, when does the diploma privilege person have to file?
That rule is quite complicated, and it's in our appendix, and it depends on the, it is based on the day when the university confers the degree, which is not the same as the date on which the student graduates. It's really very confusing. And that's one of the problems that we have had in applying this diploma privilege. I cannot answer your question right now. I can find out.
Well, that's one of the things that bothers me, obviously. And if we can't if there is any ambiguity, or if there is any problem, or if somehow the student does not know what date we're talking about, that is, I would suggest that the rule has to be simplified so that everyone should know a date. And it may be a very different date for Marquette and for Madison, because they confer degrees and handle all of this very differently, at least from what I see sitting here, which may not be true, but that's what I see. So I think that we have to take great care about this. But Mr. Kasabuki has something to say about, in response to my question.
As part of the chief in the appendices, we came up with specific dates.
We did
establish specific dates. For example, if it's going to be a May graduate, there is a specific deadline date rather than this 30 days after the degree was conferred.
Yeah.
If it's an August graduate, there is a specific date by which the application has to be filed. If it's a December graduate, there's a specific date by which the application has to be filed.
That's
good. I believe
this
is in the change to the appendices.
All right. And we don't see the appendices. These appendices are adopted by the board, and we don't approve or disapprove. We can just read them at our leisure in the statute books. Are they printed in the statute books?
Yes. John is correct. We have eliminated the ambiguity that I was talking about. That was there before. It is no longer there.
Have your appendices been adopted, and are they in effect?
The board voted and approved the appendices. I have drafted the order and sent it to Jim Morrison as the chair of the board for his signature. He indicated that the effective date of the changes to the appendices would be December 1st.
Of this year?
Of this year.
Okay.
So I'm waiting for it to come back from Jim with his signature. And then it will be published in the Wisconsin State Journal and the Wisconsin Lawyer Magazine.
Will it be published in the newest version of the statutes, or will it not be timely for that?
The procedure I follow is I send it over to the LRB, and they do and make sure it gets in as the appendix to the Supreme Court rules. I don't know what their time schedule is.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Where would a user to whom we would like to be friendly read the appendices?
They can be read in the statute book when it gets published, and they will be on our website. They are also, which is a an arm of the Supreme Court's website. The rules are there.
If they go to the main page of the Supreme Court website, www.wicourts.gov, the first page comes up, and the chief's got her picture on the side, and there's a menu bar across the top, and it says Opinions and Rules. And then if you click on that, it'll say Supreme Court, Court of Appeals. And then if you click on the Supreme Court, it'll take you to the page that has all the petitions, it has the rules are there. They're both in HTML format and PDF format, so they are available on the Supreme Court's website.
Well, let me put it, the question differently. Suppose I were a graduate of Marquette Law School. How would I know when the time begins to run and when the time ends?
We have visits to various law schools where we provide information pages to them. We put them in the individual files of the law students, and the law school itself sends out several emails to their students advising them of the filing dates. We also set up a time where we are actually at the law schools to meet with the law schools on, we call it a Q&A, a question and answer, on application issues, character and fitness issues, anything else that the law students would have a concern about to getting their applications in on time.
It is very much in the interest of the law school's administration to see that their students know what they need to do to take advantage of the diploma privilege.
In terms of numbers, how big of a problem is this? How many, for instance, last year, how many people filed late?
Three, I believe, at the most.
The board handled a small number of appeals
appeals would be different from...
If the staff determines that there is a late application and therefore the applicant cannot take advantage of the diploma privilege, very often that applicant will appeal to our board. And we handled only two or three of those appeals. So it is not a major matter.
But there would be more that didn't get to you, I would assume, from your answer. In other words, there would be some late filings that may incur a $500 penalty, but then would be allowed by staff and would not get to you on appeal. Am I right or wrong on that?
Any late application on diploma privilege goes to the board.
Oh, okay. So everyone is appealed, so to
correct.
Speak.
Correct. It's a small number, and they all go to the board.
Of those two or three appeals, how many took the bar exam?
None.
What was their reason?
The most recent one was that Madison, the student had not completed all of his coursework. He had some research to do and a paper to write for a course that was based on a paper. He thought that as the summer went on, that it would make him an August graduate because the time was passing. He did not realize that UW gets provisional grades from its professors. So his professor had given him a pass provisionally, subject to getting his coursework done. And then when the coursework was put in, the student became a May graduate, not, as he had assumed, an August graduate. But by that time, he was too late to file an application as a May graduate.
I'm not seeing how an increase in the penalty for a late application would have, you know.
It would have made no difference whatsoever for that student.
Of the two or three, were there
others? That's the one I remember. Others are more human kinds of issues. Not the dog ate my homework, but my grandmother was sick, and you know that kind of problem arises occasionally. It's not very much, and as I say, the part of the impetus for making this petition to increase the fee was to help to persuade those board members who think this rule should be enforced absolutely, to give them a little more incentive to hear the cause that the applicant is offering for his late application.
What is the reason for having to have a particularized time that even according to you, who is familiar with it, is difficult to interpret? Why have such a narrow window like that?
I don't know how to avoid a deadline. Somewhere along the line, the application has to come in. If we could, I am no great believer in these deadlines. I sort of like to go with you, but if we say they should be in on February 1st, we can say, well, we'll take them for an extra week or two or three, and people are going to find out about it. But then it comes in 4 weeks late. Well, is that reasonable? I don't know. I fear a deadline is required.
The earlier the applications come in gives the board staff, particularly our character and fitness investigator, a chance to review the information, get the questions out to the applicant. The applicant can get the information in so that ideally the applicant can then be certified and take part in the large group swearing-in ceremonies rather than having these piecemeal swearing-in ceremonies once a month or at the convenience of the justices.
Mm-hmm.
So by establishing a specific date, and we tell them early in the school year to get your applications in so we can begin working on it.
Mr. Kazabucki, is the 2 to 3 individuals a year, is that pretty consistent with your observations and experiences?
Yes, sir. In the 2.5 years that I've been here, that's pretty much the case.
And based on your review of the record, is that consistent with the
yes,
past?
Sir. Yes, sir.
What I've heard about one and then a couple of the others for this current year. But what are the problems or what are the issues that raising the $500? The student who was under the misapprehension about the teacher turning in a provisional grade, that clearly wouldn't implicate this proposed rule. What are some of the circumstances that you're aware of where this would actually remedy the problem?
With the small numbers, it's hard to pinpoint exactly what their reasons for their delay were. Some of them may have been the individual was ill, had potentially some had a financial situation where they couldn't come up with the application fee at the beginning, but then knew that he was going to get hit with a subsequent late fee. There's no real specifics that I could give you.
When's the last time anyone who's been late has had to sit for the bar exam rather than take advantage of the diploma privilege?
Not since I've been here in the 2.5 years, and I don't recall seeing anything from my review of past minutes or where they've had to sit for the bar exam. Occasionally, more particularly from UW, there are applicants who do sit for the bar exam because they have not followed the diploma privilege track. That would be the more likely scenario.
Thank you.
Mr. Kay,
yes, sir.
Your character and fitness investigator is here. Would that distinguished gentleman have anything to add?
If you wish to appear, you may. Mr. Kasabaki, are you done?
Yes, ma'am. Unless you have a...
Thank you very much for hearing me. First of all,
state your name
for the records.
Ben Hopkins. I'm a staff member with the Board of Bar Examiners. I'm the character and fitness investigator and the admission on motion manager. I handle those two areas. As character and fitness investigator, I handle every single file that comes in. That's approximately 1,200 to 1,500 files a year. The diploma privilege portion alone is about 400 to 450 per year. This year, one person was late, the person that Mr. Houston was talking about. During that time, our diploma privilege manager was out on medical leave, and I had to handle that situation. He called 2 months after the deadline date to talk to us about it. At that time, he explained it to me, and I remember the phone call vividly. He had no idea that he was going to graduate, as Mr. Houston said. I talked him through the method of obtaining the board's approval for his admission based on proof of practice, although he was at least 2 months late. I helped him with his petition to the board, and they approved it. That gentleman is, I believe, now complete with his character and fitness and almost ready for certification for admission. So this year, one person, and that's it. All the others filed timely. Last year, two people that I can remember, and I've been here 6 years, and I've never seen anyone from Diploma Privilege, to my knowledge, take the bar exam, be required to take the bar exam. That's not saying it hasn't happened. That's just saying in my memory, I don't recall any of them ever having to.
Is that good or bad?
I think that's good. There are approximately 5 per year that graduate from the 2 law schools in Wisconsin that do not take the diploma privilege. They go home to whatever state they came from and take the bar exam there. That's about 5 a year from all classes. This year, a person from Alaska who graduated from UW came back to take the bar exam. So they sometimes do come back. So it's very, very few people. The new rule sets a definite date for them to apply. Every deadline is based on their file date. The file date is very important for all the deadlines in diploma privilege, all the deadlines in the bar exam. Our admission based on proof of practice basically has no deadlines. Once they file, they have 1 year to complete the application process. Generally, when I started, it was 6 months to a year on average. That means some people would finish in 3 months, some people would take the full year. I'm getting people completed now 3-4 weeks at a time. They're completing and certified and ready for admission. The rule, as I understand it, is going to increase that workload by accepting all states, which I think is a good idea. But it's still going to be that easy. The reason I came over here, basically, is the filing date. It's my understanding that the filing date, based on a U.S. Supreme Court rule, takes the Board of Bar Examiners out of the same situation that every other court agency in this state has. Our clerk of courts stamps affidavits and files that come in on the day they're arrived in their office. We're going to have to change that, and we're the only court agency that will. If the rest of the court agencies adopt the U.S. Supreme Court rule, I would certainly have no problem with it. But being the only court agency in Wisconsin that I know of that has to change the rules because our board thinks it's more friendly, I have to disagree with that. We have to search, then, for a date. We have to open it if it's no, if there's no date on the envelope. And I went through the mail this morning and came up with a couple of dozen envelopes, many of them.
Are you talking about the CLEs, or are you talking about this?
This is, if SCR 4014 has the same rule.
Well, you don't have to worry about it now if there's no deadline, right? If the deadline is February, you know, it doesn't matter. You don't have to look at anything. I know you did to get a pilot program of understanding.
We have to, that's for the CLE. It says the application is timely filed for SCR 4014, and it has the same rule.
I understand that, but still, if the application is filed, you know, you're going to have a fixed rule as to when somebody graduates, so you can work back from that, right?
Yes.
So, if working back from that, if you decide that that date is, and I'll make up a date, February 1, things that come in December, you don't have to worry about, or January.
Generally.
Right.
But the date that it comes in, the date that it's stamped filed, is the date that all of the deadlines from that point.
I understand that, but there's no extra work, there's no problem until you get to the date that it's due.
Correct.
Then you have to start looking.
Correct. So basically we're going to have two dates to worry about, one the date when it comes in, and then when the deadline date comes up, we're going to have to go through all the files and see if everybody is current and on time.
Well, what difference? If it comes in today and it's not due to February 1, what difference does it make whether you stamp it today or stamp it the day it was mailed? What difference does it make to the staff?
When it comes up to February 1, she says,
that's right.
We would have to start looking at all of them closer.
That's right. February 1.
When they come in.
Right. And what percent will come in on February 1?
At this point, very few. Then why change the rule?
That's the point you're trying to make.
Yes, ma'am. We had one this year, a couple last year. Why change the rule for three people in 2 years? Why bother?
I am not understanding your reference to file date.
When the application comes into our office, we open up the envelope and stamp it filed if it's complete and has the fee that's required. If it's not complete, we stamp it received, contact them and tell them that it's not complete, they have to complete it. Then we stamp it filed when it comes back complete, when they provide the rest of the information.
And your stamping it filed means it is on time.
Officially on time. This is the date that everything else comes off of. This is the date that all deadlines fall to. If there's a deadline date of 3 months from that date, it's easy to handle.
Well, is there such a thing, a deadline? So if your deadline is February 1 for CLE, are there other deadlines that come due?
I can't speak to CLE. I don't work in that portion of the office. I can only speak to the application portion, the admissions portion, and we have several deadlines in bar exam and in diploma privilege.
Like what?
Again, I only work in the motion department.
Just in what you work on. What is a deadline that is...
I don't have any deadlines in my area. In the diploma privilege, there's a deadline for filing. There's a deadline for completion. There's a deadline for getting all of the material in. In bar exam, there's a deadline for getting all the material in to be eligible to set. There's a deadline for special accommodations. There's a deadline.
Is that a flat date deadline, or does it depend on when you filed your application?
That I couldn't tell you. I believe it's a set deadline in the filing rules.
No, that's what I'm trying to figure out. What does it matter that if it's January 1 or January 2 and January 4? Does it matter as long as it's before February 1 or whatever the date is? Because nothing else depends on the filing date.
If we received something January 4 and it was mailed on January 1, it may not have a difference. But if it was filed or if it was mailed on January 4 and it doesn't have a date on the envelope and it doesn't have a date inside because it's just the application, we have no idea when to set it.
Why do we care if it's not due until February 1?
Oh, well, if it's past February 1.
Okay. But past February 1, but before February 1, you don't care.
If it's past February 1 and it has no dates on it, when do we stamp it? When did they mail it? Do we call them or do we write them a letter according to the rule of the U.S. Supreme Court and ask them to prepare an affidavit of mailing? I don't know how many are late in bar exam. I do know that this year I was handling diploma privilege, and I do know that the only one that came in late was 2 months late, and he was helped by staff to make a petition to the board for his admission.
I'd like, if I may, just to follow up to make sure I have the rest of the story on that one. And that is, you were able to assist him to actually, because of his circumstance, to make a application for admission on proof of practice elsewhere. Is that what I heard?
No, diploma privilege.
Oh, on diploma
privilege. I was working diploma privilege because the diploma privilege manager was out on medical leave at that time.
So he petitioned based on proof of practice. No, my notes
petitioned
are wrong.
Based on the information he gave me over the telephone that he could take to the board for a waiver of the deadline rule.
Not on proof of practice.
Or
okay.
Diploma privilege.
Got it. Thank you. You just want a simple rule. Simple rule is when it comes in, that's it.
Make it the same for everybody. A simple rule, when it gets there, it's filed. It's stamped, filed, and it's ready to go. There's no reason to change a rule and make it more difficult than it needs to be. Reading this rule is very difficult.
Justice Brasser?
I'm not quite understanding. Let's say a University of Wisconsin student will complete all the credits sometime in May of next year. What do they have to file with you and when?
They have to file the application, completed application, with a authorization and release form and the fee for diploma privilege by before it was 30 days after, by 30 days after the, not the graduation, but the conferral of JD. Now they've set a specific date that it has to be filed for, which makes it much easier for the diploma privilege manager. That date is advertised to all students in many different forms, so they know when they have to file, when that application has to be in our office. They know that well in advance. As a matter of fact, we've already, for December and next May of 2009, we've already distributed that. So they know well in advance of when they need to do what they need to do. That comes with a check. Sometimes all we get for an application is the application form, which is not dated. It's dated for that year, that graduation year. That form is not dated. We get it sometimes hand-delivered. We sometimes get it UPS that may or may not have a date on it, but when we get them by mail, which is 80% or more by mail, oftentimes the envelope has no date. It has no commercial stamp on it. Some envelopes just have an ink line through the stamp that the post office, if their machines are not working that day, will just line it out. There's no date inside. If we go inside and we pull the check may have been written by a parent 2 months prior.
I don't understand. Why doesn't the application say name blank, John Smith, date blank, and you fill it in? I mean, there's what?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Would that take care of the problem?
It may, but it doesn't.
No, it doesn't, because they could put in any date.
And it's
January 2nd and not mail it to you till March 30th.
That's true, too. It could be any date. They could put in any date prior to the deadline date.
So do you commence the character and fitness after the filing?
Immediately on filing, once it's entered into our system, I get the file and write them a letter on what we need to complete the character and fitness. Generally, I ask for a criminal history and a driving abstract. If there's something in the application that requires more information, I request more information. For example, if someone has a DUI on the record and it's very recent, I ask for a police report to see how they handled it, if they possibly were very belligerent to the officers, if they fought, things like that. Otherwise, a large percentage of the applicants breeze right through. The ones that go to the board, I think I had one that went to the last meeting and two that went to the meeting before.
I'm sorry to be so obtuse, but now, for instance, Marquette graduates, the dean always seems to come here and talk about how they got their degree one day and they're here the next day. I'm not computing all this.
I don't know. I know that there's a dichotomy between Marquette and UW in the way they handle graduation and conferral of the degree. I don't know how that works. The diploma privilege manager may know how it works, but Marquette is usually the first one to get the information to the board so that we can certify their students. Many of the students who have filed already are complete for character and fitness for May of 2009. They do it very fast at Marquette.
When they are sworn in here, they have the character and fitness approved because Mr. Kasabuki gets up and says they've all been certified.
Yes,
so
ma'am.
So you have gone through every single one of them.
Yes,
or whoever
ma'am.
Is in charge in the office.
Yes, ma'am.
And if they don't pass through you, they're not here.
That is
they'll
correct.
They'll have to be sworn in at a later time.
That is correct. There are still maybe 10 or 12 graduates from May who haven't completed character and fitness. Some of them haven't even started. There's several from the bar exam in the same situation.
You check every statement as to where they've worked, or if it looks okay, it's good enough.
We check the address of where they work and compare that to the address of where they say they lived over the past 10 years. And if there's a dichotomy, if there's a difference between that, say if they worked in Milwaukee but they live in Manhattan.
You don't write the employer and say, did he work for you?
We do select particular employers and send them a form.
But not across the board?
No.
Something triggers this?
Something triggers it, and we do ask for employment verification. Specifically, the most recent and the longest, generally.
Mm-hmm.
We also ask for character references, 6 of them.
Do you check the DA's or WCCA here to see
only
if they're
if
on it?
Something that triggers
only
it.
If it triggers. I'm just trying to clarify to the court. That was my understanding.
We have
if
learned.
Something triggers, then you do it. But otherwise, if everything looks okay on the paper, all the dates match, so nothing is empty or there's no gap, then
And I do send the request for criminal history and driving abstract from the jurisdiction in which they live. If they're from Michigan and they're going to school here, I ask for Michigan in here. They've been here 3 years. They lived in Michigan all their life. So I ask for those too, for example. We have a saying at the staff level, if someone has a problem, they like to jump up, wave their arms, and tell us that they're having a problem. For example, we may have someone with 3 or 4 theft reports, several disorderly conducts, 3 or 4 bar fights. We know we have to look into that person a little closer. We had one recently with several drunk driving arrests over a period of time, plus some underage alcohol when they were in college and high school. Person may have a problem. We need to look at that person a little closer. 90%, let me rephrase that, a very high percentage, go through our office without ever having a problem. We ask for a criminal history and a driving record. If that matches what they've already told us, they're out. They're done. All they have to do is get sworn in, get their diploma, and get sworn in. We need the diploma.
Are there any other questions?
The applicants have to supply their own driving record?
Yes. Our rule currently says that they are required to provide what we ask for.
And how do they do that?
They just contact the Department of Justice Crime Information Bureau for the criminal history, and the driving record costs them $5. And generally, it takes less than a week for them to get that to me.
Are there any other questions? Hearing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your appearance today. Thank you. Does anyone else wish to appear on 0814? Seeing no one and hearing no one, I close the hearing on 08-14 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 40.14.2 relating to applications for admission and 40.13.3H fee for late applications under the diploma privilege. The hearings for today are adjourned. The court will be out immediately and we'll discuss and I hope decide 805, 806, and 814. We are adjourned.